October 1917. Somewhere in France. Dear folks, our noon mess is a little delayed, so I have run down to the YMCA for a few minutes. France is a fine country when the weather is warm and sunny, as it is today. When we reached this camp last evening, it was raining, and the outlook was dismal as we squeezed 10 men into a small tent which leaked and had a wet floor. Every camp we hit seems the same. There is always rain and mud, but the next day the sun is out, and we shave, wash, dry out, look around, and decide that it is a good place to camp after all. We shift from one camp to another, and after spending one night anywhere, we feel perfectly at home there. We have had another night on the water with very rough water and no comfortable staterooms as we had when crossing the Atlantic. In fact, we were in horse stalls. Some of the stalls were filled with horses and the rest with us. One man and I found our way down into the forward hold and covered ourselves with hay. But the wind began to blow too hard, and we moved into a nearby stall, taking some hay with us while the horse attendants, Tommies, were not looking. A minute later, the spray and waves began falling into the hole, which was open to the sky, although about 5 decks below the open deck on top, and we congratulated ourselves on getting out of the way before getting soaked. Just before daylight, I went on deck and saw our approach to France. Of course, I should like to describe where we are, but such interesting details must wait. A few minutes ago, we watched a large dirigible fly over the camp. Airplanes and hydroplanes are often seen. Our travels are not over yet, this stop being only temporary. My next writing will undoubtedly be from another camp. We miss not seeing newspapers. In England, we had freedom outside camp and could buy papers or anything else. I have no woolen socks except those issued, and these would be most welcome if anyone is thinking of mailing anything across. If I am going to get my dinner, I must get over to our part of the camp and get in line. Remember me to Alfred, your loving son and brother, Chandler. A few days later, somewhere else in France. We now feel more as if we have arrived, as we are now quartered in a small village, a very small and characteristically French one, not too far from the front. No longer are we in a big enclosed camp among British, Canadian, Australian, and other soldiers, and German prisoners, and so on, as we have hitherto been. We have this place entirely to ourselves, with its one or two roads, public fountain, wayside shrine, clock tower, wine shops, orchards, community washing shed, and everything unchanged, except for a few shacks erected for mess sheds, YMCA, etc., of our American troops. I like the place, in spite of the inevitable mud. Since our arrival this afternoon, part of our company has been billeted, and the rest of us are quartered in the YMCA hut, where I happen to be in charge at present, until the appointed corporal returns. Our ride here was long and tedious, although we passed a lot of interesting sights, such as aviation fields and other things, which can't be told. What French I have tried out so far on the natives seems to have worked all right. I can't comprehend much of theirs, however. As our captain lined up for a very short talk on this PM, the sound of heavy guns could be heard very plainly. Whether it was from the actual front or from practice nearby is a debated question. Tonight, I sleep in the YMCA hut. Sometime we hope to sleep twice in the same place. That would be the height of luxury. We are tired for fare. With lots of love, Chandler. October 11, 1917. Dear Mother, we are on our way, all right, and are going at a good rate. On account of the censorship, I won't attempt to give many details, but there is apparently to be a chance of sending a little mail home in a day or two. I will write now before I get seasick. There is a little motion now, but I am all right. I have been fairly comfortable all the time so far. There are a lot of men of all kinds on board, Americans and others, including aviators, who are envied because they are given the accommodations of officers, although they are merely students who have no commissions yet. The weather has been good, although it is dark tonight, and the wind was strong today. The men, some of their time talking to the sailors of the ship, some of whom have been at Gallipoli or the Jutland battle. Tomorrow, our company is to furnish a guard detail of 68 men, whose duty is mostly to keep soldiers away from forbidden parts of the ship, and to see that they wear their life preservers all of the time. It is now time to go to bed, and I expect to add some more tomorrow. I am now in the third-class dining salon, which is open for smoking, writing, etc. tonight. However, it is now about 9 o'clock, and we must go to bed. This is the next night. The greatest event of today was a widespread epidemic of seasickness. We awoke this morning in a strong wind and a choppy sea, which caused the liner to pitch a good deal. There were some great old waves which came over the bow at times. Sherman and I have escaped the violent symptoms. Also Jack Wiley. Dave Hitchcock has been rather badly off. Riker Gowan, friend of Verena Maycomber, who bunks in my stateroom, has been badly affected and has been in bed all day. He is better tonight. Several of my squad were on guard today, and all of them were sick more or less. After today, I might conclude that nothing makes me sick and have hopes of a pleasant voyage. The only other discomfort is being a stuffy place to sleep in. All day we have been out of sight of land, but now it has cleared up nicely, and a couple of lighthouses are in sight on the horizon. Also, a brilliant planet, which I believe is Venus. It is a fine night now, fairly calm and very clear. The weather is warm and delightful on deck, so I almost hate to stay in this stuffy room, which is going up and down all the time because it is near the stern of the boat. Most of the work on board is done by young English boys, very young, who are the most industrious and at this time the most patient and cheerful lot I ever saw. None of them ever refuse any request, and they never lose their good temper. I don't see how they do it. I think my business affairs are wound up in Hartford all right. I paid up in full a $50 Liberty bond at the Connecticut General, on which I suppose there will not be any interest forthcoming until next April or so. I wish you would write immediately to the New Republic Publishing Company to have the magazine forwarded to me at my new address. Company C, 101st Machine Gun Gat, with American Expeditionary Force, care of Postmaster, New York City. Or fix it up with Mr. Hayden. I wish I could say where we are, but it might be censored. With lots of love, your son, Chandler. Please write often, although I don't know how much mail we can get. October 27, 1917. Dear folks, my fountain pen has run dry as I was writing my diary, which I have kept since leaving the U.S., and which I expect to show you sometime when the details of our traveling may be disclosed. We have so far been having a most interesting time, and I have enjoyed it almost all the time, my only illness being a headache which lasted only an hour or two on the day we landed in this particular place. Until the last couple of days, we have been on the go continually. In fact, since leaving Connecticut, we have never slept two nights in the same latitude and longitude until last night. We have been treated to railroad rides by night and by day, especially at night. We have seen something more or less of England under war conditions, including women munition workers at work all night in their pajama-like uniforms, also female streetcar conductors, etc. Various war restrictions on eating, such as no sugar in restaurants, and very little bread, butter, etc. There is no petrol available. Therefore, no autos are seen except motor trucks, called lorries, and a few Fords, which have some reason for being allowed at large. The towns, although not very near London, is darkened at night, with only dim, transparent signs on shop windows to tell what kind of a store it is. We are now in our second rest camp. Our first was not ideal in some ways. We arrived just at dawn and spent a rainy 24 hours in old, worn-out tents in an out-of-the-way, muddy country region, leaving just at daylight the next day. However, I enjoyed it, because I got a glimpse of English country which I thought very attractive. Nearby was a small village with thatched cottages and everything so much more neat and picturesque than most places at home. Our present hangout is a new camp in a large city park, which is much as if the government should decide to quarter a large body of troops in Keeney Park in Hartford. This park, however, is approached by a fine boulevard with good residences on either side. This rest camp for American troops on their way to the front is still in process of construction. Right at the head of our street, the road is being remade by a gang of German prisoners with Tommies as guards. While we are in line waiting for our eats, some waits usually, we have our choice of watching the Teutons with picks and shovels leisurely digging in the road, or of gazing at airplanes over our heads. For most of the time, there are one or two to be seen. This morning we had a drill, and while resting, we watched on machine do some good turning and diving for several minutes. Another amusement is talking to the numerous English soldiers who have seen service. Wounded men are everywhere, wearing a peculiar blue uniform with a red necktie. Dave and I have patronized vaudeville, indistinguishable from American, only a little better, and moving pictures, also just the same as in the U.S. In fact, half of the bill was American-made. In many ways, this might be American anyway. The girls and women look and dress the same. The parks and city houses are the same. And, of course, most of the customs. We are getting used to English money gradually, but it seems somewhat strange. I have in my pocket now an assortment, including 10-shilling notes, half-crowns, florins, shillings, a sixpence, some pennies, and a halfpenny. The pennies are large and heavy, causing one to spend them quickly and reduce the weight. Money goes fast, as there is much temptation to buy various things in the shops. All sweets are expensive. Clothing seems cheap. As soon as we are let out of camp, I expect to take a train for town and get a bath, something I need. On the ship we came over in, I took salt water baths, but fresh water was very sparingly supplied. I enjoyed the ride over. Early in the trip, we had a day of choppy water. I hope you got my letter mentioning that incident. But Sherman and I escaped seasickness in spite of a multitude of harrowing sights and odors. I ate three meals as usual. Our last day on ship was extremely interesting, but since I can't tell our route, I can't give much of a description of the scenery or the events. They were kind enough to bring us to our port, somewhere in England by daylight. We did not see any submarines, but one freighter, which was not far from us, was sunk. I ate the noon meal with Sherman today, and he seems to be getting along well, and to be taking good care of himself. I would not worry about his situation, since he can pick a good company, and there are plenty of good fellows here. As long as he keeps well and doesn't spend his money too fast, he will be all right as he is now. My first trip into town, when we came here, was with Dave, Jack Wiley, and Rick Gowan in my squad. My squad is all a good bunch. It is time to leave camp, and also it is too cold to continue writing. I trust that this will reach you in good season. With lots of love, Chandler. November 3, 1917. Somewhere in France. Dear folks, mail comes very irregularly. For example, last night I got your letter dated October 13, whereas a few days before that one came, which you sent on the 22nd or 24th, I forgot which. We were sorry to hear of your worrying, although it was inevitable before you heard of our arrival. By the way, we don't know yet whether you received our cable, which we sent when we hit shore. It is evident that you lost more sleep about our trip than we did. At least, I didn't lose any. We all went to bed at 9 and can only regret that we were cheated out of half an hour or more every night on account of our traveling. When we go back, we will have that much more extra sleep. As for our present situation, we are at least fairly comfortable in a snug billet with thick stone walls and a stove, for which we are now furnished soft coal as well as wood. We have plenty of food, the present trouble being lack of variety in the cooking thereof. The Maire de la Commune told me that not a bomb has been dropped on this village by the Germans since the war began, so you need not worry about us for some time. So far, the weather is much warmer than it is at Hanover at this time of year. Last night, we had our first touch of snow, but it had all disappeared by morning. This is our coldest day, yet I am riding in an unwarm tent of the YMCA without actually freezing. Last Saturday afternoon, Dave H. and I started out for a walk. First, we explored the nearby town, the metropolis of the neighboring, and one of the two or three largest places in the prefecture. We went into the church. I don't know whether to call it a cathedral or not. It is large, and evidently quite an old structure. Then we looked over the shops and witnessed the parade of a long procession of French soldiers with several bands playing. Where they were going, I don't know. Then we went on through a French camion headquarters, with a lot of trucks being cleaned and repaired. When we got out on the road to, or in other words, towards the front, and branched off to climb a steep hill with a tower on it, we were slightly mixed up in the points of the compass. And as it was getting towards supper time, we asked De Poilu the way to our village, hoping that we could reach it by a shortcut. "Oh, mon pauvre," he exclaimed, "you must go straight through the town. You are going just the opposite direction." All in French, of course. Then he showed us our own familiar hill, where we go to get our firewood. It was beyond a plain of about 3 miles' breadth. Of course, we set out at double time and managed to get to the supper line. At present, I am sitting on my bed, with snow coming in on my back in small quantities through the cracks in the window. This morning, it is snowing rather hard. I wonder what we will do at drill. In the New Republic for October 30th, there is a little write-up called A Holiday in France, which gives in its first paragraph or two a very good picture of French country such as we see around here, except that this place has not been in the hands of the Germans in this war. If I can find them, I will enclose 1. Letter from President Huntington acknowledging receipt of money for a $50 Liberty bond. This ought to be kept as a receipt. 2. A little note from the young lady downstairs, which will serve as an exercise in French for Emily or mother. We have not been paid since leaving the U.S. I'm almost broke. Don't forget to keep mail coming. Lots of love, Chandler. December 8, 1917. Dear Father, we have just signed up for $10,000 insurance, making it payable half to you and half to Mother in case of my death. As you may know, these policies, when they become a claim by death or total disability, are payable in 240 monthly installments of $57.50 each. Most of the fellows here believe that during the war, at least, it is well to have the maximum protection. I have a letter from Mother telling of receiving the allotment for September, and for a while was worried because she mentioned having spent it, but after remembering that I had drawn the money in advance, I lost no more sleep over it. I trust that the future $20 checks will be put into the Riverside, and I will tell you when to put it into Liberty Bonds and other investments. I am broke at present, and scarcely draw a check on the Riverside Trust Company, although there is supposed to be a small balance there. I may yet take a chance and draw a dollar or two, although I don't know that you haven't withdrawn the money under your authority. Don't do it if you can help it, at least until you are out of communication with me. Mail is coming in small bunches nowadays. The latest we have received from home is Emily's letter of November 11th. Mailed the 12th, reached here about December 5th. Our regular billet has lately been used for a bunch quarantined for measles, but in a very few days we hope to be back, which will seem good after living with the squad divided in inferior quarters. The fellows are saving up their Christmases and other packages received to celebrate the return to our own billet. Since I have been living away from home, as I have done no letter writing, with the exception of one to Alfred. We have been having some weather with a touch of l'hiver in it, and it is some relief to have the ground and roads frozen, since it saves an hour a day spent in cleaning shoes and puttees. I have drawn and cashed a check for $2, for which I gave myself 11.30 francs, and I will use it to get my laundry out of hock, get a tub bath when I get into town, and perhaps buy some Christmas cards to send to the USA. Dr. Meal was in town yesterday, but didn't preach today, Sunday, December 9th. Keep in touch with Mrs. Tilton and Meal, and you can probably get news about us. Your loving son, Chandler. December 16th, 1917. Dear folks, having bought some ink and filled my fountain pen, I intend to reform and write letters. Incidentally, I hope you are maintaining your schedule of a letter every day or two for us. Dr. Meal spoke this morning at the YMCA. Also last night, there was a pretty good movie show there. It was a success in that the machine only broke down a couple of times. At the last previous attempt, it would die out every other minute. Things are going pretty well now. In other words, the personnel of the billet seem to be settled for a while, the stove burns all right, and we have been paid. In accordance with my old habit of not carrying much money with me, I poked 120 francs into the Farmers Loan Trust Company of New York. I thought I might mention that I had an account with them, although it will always be small owing to the amount I allotted home. I am anxious to know whether the quarterly dividends, or rather the October dividend, on the American TNT stock came through all right. Jack Wiley has just received a telegram from his father at Paris, and is expecting to see him there, if Mr. Wiley can find out where we are and get permission to make the trip. Just before dinner today, Madame La Patronne brought us up a large basket full of fine pears. After dinner, I returned the basket and was invited in by the mayor to have a drink of his vin rouge with him. I had quite a long conversation with him and his household. They are fine, substantial people, and are certainly good to us. Their most frequent expression is, "Quand vous avez besoin," referring to about anything they own. One afternoon last week, I went into town, but didn't manage to spend much. Managed to get some New Year's cards, which I must address to de suite. Since you folks have mentioned seasickness, I may as well proclaim that I did not suffer from it, although many did on one or two days before we hit shore. A slight lack of fresh air below decks was the only thing that bothered me. That is ancient history now. With lots of love, Chandler. Dear folks, my writing at present is necessarily much interrupted for the reason that I am serving as cashier for the local YMCA, changing money and selling purchase checks as in a soda fountain, almost forgotten word. The cash that we take in is certainly varied. Purchasing power of a coin is determined by its size rather than by any devices stamped on it. In one pile, I have French, English, Canadian, Belgian, Italian, even one Greek coins, all passing for 10 centime pieces. There are also bills of a lot of French cities worth 50 centimes or a franc, and even some smaller billets worth 25 centimes, 5 cents. The larger paper money, 5 francs and over, is all the issue of the Bank of France. Dave and I volunteered for this job and started the system last night with a rush of business. I can now think in French money without mentally translating it into dollars and cents. The scene has changed. I am now in my billet, my home for the present. This home of ours is a low square room on the second floor of an L of a rambling village house. The approach is by private exterior stairway. Our part of the house extends out almost to the central fountain of the town. Our patron is a fine old fellow, the mayor of the village, and we are on the best of terms with him. Madame la patronne has donated us with apples, baked potatoes, hot water, etc., and sells us milk whenever we wish it. Most of the gang leave canteens at night and call in the morning to get their liter of milk. The bunch in our billet consists of my squad, which is now minus the Wesleyan man, Frank Winslow, and young Scattergood, both of whom have been transferred, together with Louis Sechtman of Hartford, Boss Holly, whom Father knows, and a kid named Sullivan, who is not in our company but belongs to the ordnance detachment. Altogether, it is a good bunch with no undesirables. The chief drawback to our joint is a low ceiling and poor light, which doesn't hit me so hard since my bed is next to the window, as is shown in the following diagram. The location of this billet is good. The window looks right down on the street where our company falls in, and we are only a few steps from our mess hall and the orderly room, company headquarters. We have to get our own wood for our little stove. The other 8 of us had a chance to visit the woods where our fuel is cut for us into meter lengths. When we each had carried a load home, we had a busy party surrounding the chopping block of Monsieur le Patron, using his buck saw, axe, and sawhorse to deadly effect. While we were working, the mayor's father, a man of 80, brought out a peculiar little chopping knife and showed us how to use it as a hatchet to cut the smaller sticks. As a result, we put in enough wood for a week. Our French hosts are very generous and always tell us to use their tools whenever we need them. The other evening, I visited the patron and his family at supper and had a long conversation with them. When I get started, I can spiel French better than you would imagine. I learned their family history and told them mine. I have just been cautioned that it is better to cut letters short and write them more frequently. I have heard nothing from home except one letter from Father, mailed the day we left. Keep them coming, and I will try to do the same. If you are interested in what to send over, I strongly recommend concentrated cocoa, coffee, etc., sweet chocolate, cigarettes, woolen socks, and wristlets, etc. Also, small electric flashlights. I suppose this will reach you between Thanksgiving and Christmas, and I hope it will find you all well. With lots of love, Chandler. I repeat my correct address, Corporal C.T. Green, C Company, 101st M.G. Battalion, American Expeditionary Forces, via New York. January 11, 1918. Dear folks, I have about 5 minutes between inspection and supper. Lately, the idea of sitting down and thinking what you were writing has grown more and more impossible and out of the question. A few words in odd moments must suffice. Without exception, we have schools and meetings for instruction every night nowadays, and I have been trying to spend the rest of evenings at a nightly school in French, taught by our interpreter, who is a very capable teacher. Several of us, including Rick Gowan, Sherman, Jack Wiley, Dave Hitchcock, and I, have been in this so-called advanced class. We have been translating English newspapers into French and carrying on all conversation in French. Pretty good dope. My squad has been changed around somewhat since our arrival here. It now contains Hobie Hyde of tennis fame and Ernie Alton, who was in my tent at Niantic. For a while, Tink Woodmansey, brother of Harold, was with us, but not now. We have been making good progress for the past few days since the Christmas and New Year's let-ups, and usually are quite ready to turn in when our evening classes are over. However, on account of rain and slush and generally unfavorable weather, we did not go out today, but had indoor work instead. By the way, I am now equipped with a good pair of rubber boots reaching to my hips, so dampness underfoot does not worry me, as it would without them. This is the third installment. This morning, we have been having a thorough examination in all of the stuff we have been going over during the last few days. Everyone was called up one by one and marked on what he knew. It has been so long since I have written that I don't know where to begin. On the day after New Year's, we had quite a little ceremony with our French instructors. When we met them out on the hills, they drew up into a line facing our company in fine military style and came to a salute. Then their officer made us a speech wishing us Happy New Year and wishing success and happiness to ourselves and to our families in America. Our commanding officer then replied in characteristic American style by merely wishing them the same, and we took up our day's work. I have with me your letter of December 7th to Sherman, which is very good, except where it dwells on your worrying about his health and condition. This was somewhat depressing to both of us to think of your worrying without being able to reassure you immediately and personally that we are all right. However, we don't blame you for feeling funny after reading Jack's letter, in which he incidentally mentioned Sherm's cold. That has been a joke for a long time around, but I don't blame you for taking it seriously. Sherman and I are both in good health at present. Since about Christmas time, I have been feeling better every day. A few more Christmas packages have come, but not any from home. A day or two ago, we received some fine homemade candy from the Greens of Alfred. A warm knitted sweater came recently from, of all person, Mr. R.H. Cole, secretary of the Connecticut General, and I was even more surprised when I read a note from him saying that he knitted himself during his idle moments. There is still hope of the boxes from you people getting here, for such things are arriving every day or so. Today is a fine, bright day, a little colder than any this week, but not uncomfortable. There is still a good deal of snow on the ground in spite of the recent thaw. It is now almost taps. I have just come from French class. The classes are held in the village schoolroom with small desks for us, and with numerous maps and charts on the wall. One side of the room is draped with the tricolor and the American flag. The young son of the family downstairs comes up almost every evening and pays a visit. His name is René, age 16 years. He likes to look at American magazines that have pictures and to converse as much as possible. The French mayor asked me last night if I had read Le Grand Discours of President Wilson, meaning his speech to Congress on December 8 on the peace conditions. The Frenchman seemed to approve of it, but had the erroneous idea that it was delivered in New York. Mr. Wiley arrived at the town near our village yesterday, and Jack was given permission to spend the day with him. Mr. Wiley is going to be stationed here, and we all expect to see him soon. I went into town a week ago, but didn't do much. Possibly may go this Sunday p.m. I will write again when a chance comes. With lots of love, Chandler. January 21, 1918. Dear folks, last night your letter came, dated December 15, and replying to an old one of mine in which I described our billet, the old one. However, last week we moved to a new and much better room, large, high, and light, with plastered walls. It is easily accessible, being on the second floor, in the rear of one of the village cafes. Just now, the cafe is closed for a month on account of some illegal selling of spirituous liquors. This is a place that is always in trouble with the authorities. The weather lately has been warm and spring-like, especially yesterday and today. There is much discussion as to whether this is really spring or only a January thaw. It looks like the real thing. The snow has all gone, and the roads and high grounds are temporarily fairly dry. The best weather we have had, and it makes everyone feel good. Yesterday morning, we had an inspection, but our afternoon was free, and I had a great desire to take a walk to a place of great historic interest not far away. No one else was ambitious enough to walk that far, so I started out alone in the direction I thought was right. For part of the day, I had a ride on a motor truck, but at a certain crossroads, I had an idea that I wanted to turn off the main road. So I gave a jump and landed in the middle of three French soldiers who had just started out from that town for a walk. It turned out that they were going for an afternoon walk to the same point that I was bound for. So I joined and was with them for all the rest of the afternoon, answering all the while in my fluent, French. They were all Parisians and all fine fellows, the best French privates I have met. Their regiment is a noted one which was decorated at Verdun and has also fought along the Somme, which my friends said was the worst part of the French front on account of the mud. They declared that in 8 days they were going into the trenches again. In an hour or so, after walking cross lots and over hills, with a wonderful view, we came to the historic spot, which I hardly dare describe. It was thronged with French and American sightseers, officers and men, who now replace the ordinary tourists who used to crowd the places before the war. Together with the Frenchmen, I then descended into the village itself, where there are more places that must be seen by all visitors. In the register, my companions in blue wrote the following under the date of January 20, 1918. Trois poilus de Regiment au promenade avec un corporal américain, under which we all signed our names. About this time, I came back from the 15th to the 20th century, brought back by the realization that I had only an hour to get to the railroad, which was several kilometers distant. After saying goodbye to the poilu, with some regret, I lit out at a good clip, passing through several small towns, all much alike, until I came in sight of the gare. It was then pretty dark, and I was 12 kilos from my home station. Fare, 20 centimes or 14 cents. Opposite the station, there was a cafe, full of American and French soldiers, all of whom were waiting for the 5:17 train, the same as I. In spite of the vehement assurances of the waitresses, or barmaids, or whatever you call them, that the train wouldn't leave until 6 o'clock, all of the customers filed out at 5:17 and waited in the station until the train came an hour afterwards. It is time to turn in after a busy day. Sherman and I are both in fine health. With lots of love, Chandler. Postscriptum. My government insurance for $10,000, mentioned in previous letter, has gone through, and my application bears the number 10841. Better write it down somewhere. I have father's good letter enclosing clippings of Wilson's address to Congress. As far as I can make out, we can get out of all this war news that is given out by the authorities in our daily papers so that only local news be enclosed in the letters from the USA. Signed, C.T.G. January 30th, 1918. Dear folks, on account of the late hour, I must make this as businesslike as possible. Tonight, your letter of December 30th came, enclosing some interesting clippings. As you may have surmised from his letters, Louis Seckman was billeted with us at the time of writing, in the exterior room of the mayor's house. I bought some firewood today from the mayor's 80-year-old father, a good old man who has the virtue of speaking slowly and distinctly, so that it is easy to understand him. Tonight, I sent Father a birthday cable and included the words, "Don't send shoes," with reference to your suggestion in your latest letter about his sending his high boots paid out of allotment money. Didn't appeal to us. We are issued 3 pairs of heavy shoes, besides high rubber boots and moccasins, and more would be superfluous. Don't be anxious to lavish our allotment money on us unless we cable for it, if you please. Sherman and I have each received 1 box from home. Although woolen socks are always good, as a rule, we are well provided with knitted goods. Tonight, our supply sergeant was issuing woolen helmets, but was having hard work making men take them, since everyone already has 2 or 3, and the cold weather seems to be over. Of course, we can use warm things next winter, but some optimistic souls hope that we will be back by then. One article in particular that you said you were about to send sounded very good, namely, flashlights. The sooner the better. If I had had one tonight, I wouldn't have spent 20 minutes looking for the cable office in the pitch-dark street in town. I had seen the sign over the door in daylight and knew just about where it was, within 100 yards. But the night was dark and foggy, and the regulation about lights are strictly enforced. I walked to town and back after supper and was back before 7:45, so you see it wasn't very far. In one of your earlier letters, you said something that made me think that you had us located about 6 miles from town and over a big hill. The hill is back of us. It only took me about 35 or 40 minutes to walk it tonight, although I couldn't see 2 feet in front of me. Lately, we have been having a long daily ride in motor trucks, about 15 miles each way, past all kinds of interesting sights. Salisbury Plain in England has nothing on the place where we spend the sunny daylight hours nowadays. It is a spacious area for air. Every day after lunch, Bob Case, Leonard Fisk, and other old acquaintances get together with us, Vine Parmalee and others, and talk things over. Sherman got a wonderful box of good things to eat from Uncle Vern's folks the other day. Both of us received Lowney's chocolate from Dartmouth College, a gift of the Boston alumni. I hope Alfred is feeling better than he was before Christmas. I also hope that Father's not working too hard. With lots of love, Chandler. February 6, 1918, at 3:45 a.m. Not for publication or extensive circulation. Dear Father, this may take the place of a birthday letter, since today, or rather yesterday, since it is after midnight, is the 5th. I hope you will find time to write more than you have, but I know that you must be very busy this winter, owing to the conditions the war has caused. Mrs. Rossiter sent me a card for which I will have to ask you to render my acknowledgments and thanks, because for the present the amount of mail I can send is limited. It is my pleasant duty to write a thank you letter to Uncle Vern and Aunt Mary for a wonderful box of eats, cake, candy, nuts, gum, etc., which came to me tonight, a few days later than Sherm's similar box. Our work here, I mean in the sense of travail or physical work, comes and goes in bunches. Most of last week, we were starting off in the morning with scarcely time to finish breakfast, eating our lunch of bread, bacon, and coffee several miles away, and getting back after dark, which usually meant that we had this job of cleaning up the guns after supper. This week we are having entirely different work, but I can't go into details at all. We certainly don't get all of the news in the papers over here, after all. For instance, the various congressional investigations of the War and Ordnance Departments were not mentioned until the Current and the Times and the weekly magazines arrived from the U.S. I hope that Congress won't bother the President or Secretary Baker any more than is necessary. The Army over here seems to be well provided for, and you never hear any criticism of the War Department. At least, I haven't. I am on guard again, as you might infer from the time of day. The only excitement thus far was a chimney fire. I have been reading the December Scribners, which Mother has probably seen. The article on France by Edith Wharton is one which all Americans should get through their beans. Galworthy's story I have yet to read, but I won't miss it. The article, The Face of Paris, isn't bad. Don't miss the last line of that one if you want a subject for research. During the last week or so, there has been a regular shower of belated Christmas boxes. Besides the cigarettes from Don Aldrich and the fine money belt from Uncle Charles, I received a good-sized box of candy and all kinds which came from Wanamaker's in New York, but I have no idea whom to thank for it. There were no marks to show who caused it to be sent. Perhaps you can enlighten me so I can render my remerciement later on. I hear that Sherm has a new job yesterday afternoon, driving a Ford. He was detailed to go to town and bring back one Ford, so he did, with more or less success. I never knew he could drive one. Our squad has had a good time in the billet with feeds, singing, and such amusements. One thing that amused us was the formation of the squad yesterday afternoon. So many of the men happened to be out on guard or kitchen police that only three or four were left, with a buck private acting as corporal. Then a few special details were made so that when the drill call was sounded, the squad consisted of one man, Nalvosa, as corporal, and one other, Krop, as the squad. Fortunately, we didn't take out the guns. I hope that you received the cablegram that I sent a few days ago, and that it came in time for your birthday. Last Sunday, six of us took a walk across country to the same place that I mentioned visiting a few weeks ago. We spent more time looking at the fine series of mural paintings than at anything else, pictures that correspond closely to Abbey's Holy Grail series in the Boston Public Library. It is funny to see the various imaginary pictures by the magazine artists of American soldiers in France. There are always big inaccuracies in the dress, equipment, or surroundings. For instance, we don't possess any more of the familiar wide-brimmed felt hats, although perhaps we may get some later again. Please don't let Mother or yourself worry about our health. I never felt better in my life, except for lack of sleep tonight. And Sherman seems all right, too. The record of health in this battalion is exceptionally good, according to official records. I think that I shall stop now and fry an egg, which Sergeant Hastings kindly gave me, before I post the next relief. With more love than ever to all the family, Chandler. December 25, 1918. Dear folks, tonight brought us another batch of mail, and I was fortunate enough to get a letter and your package containing the cake and the flashlight, also the woolen socks from the Dr. Taylor. The cake has disappeared, except for a fraction reserved for Sherman, who is on guard. The flashlight works well and certainly fills a long-felt want. Several times I have been on the point of buying one, but the prices at all of the French stores are not very attractive compared with the quality of the lights they offer. As for the socks, they are such fine ones that I will have difficulty in putting them on to wear in the mud. If there was any prospect of the well-known wars ending in the near future, I should certainly save them and rescue them from the army. But as it is, they can scarcely be spared from the trenches. Sherman has just come down the aisle and is sitting here reading your letter and eating the cake. He is enjoying his work as agent. The agents have a good bunch of fellows. He is in good health, as am I. Today, I have had a little headache as a result of overindulgence in rich eats from the U.S. As Dave says, it gives one a guilty feeling to stuff candy, etc., while the folks at home are so hard up for sugar. However, such orgies are preceded by weeks of comparative abstinence. Speaking of Christmas presents, the letter from Uncle Charles, which you enclosed, speaks of the money belts which he sent us. By this time, he probably received my note of thanks for mine. I wear mine all of the time. Ed Garrett of West Hartford seems to be getting along very well as YMCA secretary hero. He was in here tonight and had a sample of your cake. Young Strickland was today assigned to act as orderly for Mr. Garrett, or rather for Dr. Hasselgrave, the older YM man here. The YMCA here is starting fast and already has a large variety of goods on sale. By going down a steep hill about 10 minutes' walk, we can take advantage of a French hut with ample room for letter writing, except that it usually is filled with boisterous U.S. infantry. One man here created a sensation by displaying a wedding invitation which he had received from the girl whom he regarded as his own. He didn't know just how to take it, and numerous suggestions were offered from all sides. Finally, he consoled himself with the thought that the Christmas present he had sent her, costing 30 or 40 francs, could serve as a wedding present. The majority, including myself, are congratulating ourselves that we had no entangling alliances with the faithless female sex. Today I was on guard, together with Bob Skinner, son of Colonel Skinner of Colts. He was having, as he said, a difficult time trying to write a suitable poem for his 4-year-old daughter, who seems to be in his mind a great deal. Sherman has just brought up a letter from Alfred, one from Emily and one from Ernie Early, Dartmouth, 1918, who is evidently very near us now, but I doubt if we see him. With the usual curses of the censorship rules, I remain your loving son and brother, Chandler. P.S. We had turkey and cranberry sauce today, celebrating Washington's birthday a little late. 24th of February, 1918. This morning, there was another church service in our quarters. No hymn books or piano. A quartet from the company led the hymns, and Dr. Hasselgrave read the text by the aid of a flashlight as he stood backed up against the machine gun, while all the men were gathered around on cots. It was quite a scene, but no real description can be sent. Mr. Garrett may be able to say some where we are more than we can. So, if you know his wife, you should seek her out. Harold Kropp spent last night away from here on special mission, but was back this morning. I don't remember having any word from you about the allotment money that is allotted to you for me. Has the $20 per month been coming regularly? Also, have the dividend checks arrived for October and January on my beloved Tell and Tell stock? The government money must amount to about $100 by the time this gets to you. If Father wants to take the trouble to invest it in some good security, I would be grateful. A month or two ago was a wonderful time to get stocks and bonds, and there are plenty of good ones now. If I was home, I would probably buy a share or two of American International Corporation. I should be glad to hear that some had been bought for me, or else some of the older and stabler varieties. By the time this gets home, the campaign will be on for the new Liberty loan, and I wouldn't be sore if you took some of that for me, so long as the great wealth is safely invested. That is the main idea. I feel virtuous, having made a fire out of doors, heated some water in your cake tin, which came the other night, and taken a good sponge bath, the first in over 2 weeks. I know not when the next shall be. Your son, Chandler.
Please note, the date and the first sheet or sheets of the following letter are missing, but here is the available text.
Called the tripe, which came out once, but never again because it contains specific names of military units of our home cities, therefore was banned. You should look these up in the public or state libraries, as they would certainly interest you. Well, I shouldn't write any more now. It is a great night here, better than Christmas. I am smoking a cigar donated by Ray Gutstetter of Hartford, whose bunk is next but one to mine, and have partaken freely of candy and cake, which came to him from Trope and others of my squad. I didn't get a package myself, but it doesn't matter much. There's certainly a lot of noise and excitement here tonight, and I still have a lot to read. For instance, Sherman's letter from Alfred, Al Street, etc., and the alumni magazines. Jack Wiley, Dave Hitchcock, and others have been around comparing mail. Harry is on this side now. Also, George Ingalls. This is a great war, after all. I wish I could answer all my mail tonight, but this is all I can attempt. With lots of love, Chandler. P.S. I almost forgot to mention the fine letter from Aunt Maud came tonight. February 28th, 1918. Dear folks, I understand that we are now allowed a little more liberty in writing. So I will snatch a few minutes before I am called for duty again. We know now that there is a war going on. For one reason, because we do our work at night and take our sleep, if any, in the daytime. It was rather novel this noon to hear our cook come through the dugout brandishing a ladle and yelling, "If you fellows want any dinner, you had better get a move on and be getting up." There were still those of us who replied drowsily, "Damn the dinner. What I want is sleep." However, when it was known that there was real turkey to eat, everyone came out. Since about the time Sherman's birthday, we have been in the war area and therefore have seen neither a civilian nor a woman. Our company until last night was very comfortably quartered in a large cave, all of stone, so that it didn't even have wooden supports for the ceiling, which ceiling was 30 feet or so underground. It was a fine place, no rats or cooties, and we had lots of fun in there, the whole company being together. Sherman's bunk was just around the corner, about a few yards from mine. We had a movie show in there one night, a magician, another, and variety concerts. Also, every Sunday, a church service. This was luxury, all right. Our work was not hard, and of course everything we saw was all very new and interesting. There was almost always something going on above us. We hadn't been there more than a couple of days when we all saw a Bosch plane swoop down on a French observation balloon very near us and sent it down in flames. occupants escaped in parachutes. A couple of days later, we saw an air battle, which speedily ended with the destruction of the German. The airplane crashed down from way up, where each machine was nothing but a speck. The whole thing was in plain sight, and many of the fellows ran over to the field where the wreck landed. I was on guard, but Sherman went over and saw what was left of the machine and the two aviators. I haven't time to go on like that, but every clear day there was something going on, and many nights, too. You would never guess what part of the front we are at, and of course it would never do to tell. The town was something worse for wear, inasmuch as there was literally not a building whose walls and roof, or both, had not been wrecked by shell fire. On the whole, life was pretty good while we were at a reserve unit there. We got a lot of mail on one or two occasions. I haven't yet thanked you for the last box, which had in it some very useful things. Gloves, candles, Hershey's, chocolates. That box is what I am now using as a writing table. And a flashlight. The war has proved too rough for the flashlight. Bumping around in the trenches put it on the fritz last night. We are now in the line, and our quarters are in a nice warm dugout, safe from shells which at present are whistling by now and then. Sherman is in a different place, but expects to visit here in his capacity as liaison agent. I fear that I can't go on and describe things much. The country right here used to be wooded, but now looks as if a hurricane had passed over it, followed by a forest fire. I hope that you have taken my hint about not letting my letters be published as you once did. Judging by the experience of one or two other men here, another warning may be necessary. It only makes trouble for me, as it directly is against Pershing's orders. And furthermore, when I write letters home, I don't write them for everyone in Hartford. Well, take care of yourselves, and we will do the same. Don't worry about us, just because we have to keep those irregular hours, or you will lose more sleep than we do. This life is all right until it gets monotonous, which it hasn't yet. With lots of love from Chandler. March 5, 1918. Dear Emily, this ought to reach you before your birthday, and perhaps we will get back into civilization in time for me to get a little present to celebrate the event. How old will the budding young lady be on April 5th? 14, 15, or what? Remember when I used to get your goat by asking whether you were in the fifth grade yet? When we get back from the front, I'm going to subscribe to the AEF weekly newspaper called Stars and Stripes. It is certainly interesting to us, and probably will be to you, as it has more dope in it about our life here than I could ever write in letters. When I get the chance, I will mail you one or two home. Dave Hitchcock's folks just sent him some good magazines, and I have been looking over the January Atlantic Monthly, and noticed some things about the war that you and Mother would like to read if you haven't already. In one article, called More Letters from France, there is a fine description of the French soldier, just the way we see him every day. Nowadays, I talk for hours with Poilu from all parts of France, and also borrow their daily newspapers to read, since none in English get set up this way. One thing we do get up here, and that is some good eats. Some of the things we have had are turkey, pancakes, French fried potatoes, steaks, and other good things. Tonight, we are going to have pancakes. This is an easy day for me, as I have no time on duty during the day. However, I have to get my sleep, in fact. That is about all we ever do when we are off duty, except eat. We have been having rotten weather. But now, the sun has come out, and the snow which fell during the night is melting. Also, the airplanes are again buzzing over our heads. If they are French or American machines, they are probably observing the fire of our artillery. If they happen to be Boches, they are probably taking photos to try to locate our dugouts and our machine guns or artillery emplacements, or else they are scouting around for a chance to shoot down our big observation balloons, which are always up back of us in clear weather. If they get one of the men in the balloon, they will calmly jump out and come down in parachutes. At first, we were quite excited when they did this stunt, but now we don't think much about it. I can remember seeing 9 such parachutes coming down. A fellow who just came in says that an airplane was just brought down a minute or 2 ago in sight of here. I didn't tell you, did I, that Mr. Wiley came up here one night to see Jack for a few minutes. I had a little conversation with him. He has not been very well and is going to Nice to rest up at one of the many fine hotels there. Keep writing, ma petite sœur. The last package was fine. I'm using the Hershey chocolate box as a writing desk now. Your loving brother, Chandler. March 5, 1918. Somewhere on the front. Dear Al, how's the college man? I certainly was glad to hear that you were getting away with the Dartmouth competition, and only hope you can keep up second place and land the job on the first picking. Don't let anyone beat you out now. I suppose this won't reach you until after the time of Easter vacation, that is, if you have those things this year. For all we know, we may be getting a leave by that time, and we may not. At present, our life has its little drawbacks at times, especially when we are waiting it out in a hole in the ground, exposed to a good windy snowstorm, and during the wee small hours of the night. Now everything is okay. A few minutes ago, I was wakened for dinner, and we had steak and French fried potatoes, with seconds on the ladder. Then someone came around and issued us a good big candle apiece, and then some cigarettes. Oh, what more could a guy want? You see, we live about 20 feet below ground, with the entrance of the dugout carefully camouflaged to prevent its being spotted by Boche avions, which occasionally sail over us. This morning, I saw Sherman for the first time since we have been up in the line. As you know, his job is that of a liaison agent, and he came over today to bring some message from the sector where he is stationed to ours. To do it, he had to go some distance in sight of the Germans. Jack Wiley is here with us, and the other evening, his father found his way up here to see him for a few minutes. You would scarcely recognize Mr. Wiley with his steel helmet and gas mask as he came up in the Ford that brought our grub to us. He hasn't been very well lately, and he is now going down to Nice, way down near the Italian border, to rest up. Yesterday, I was talking to a French soldier whose home is down near there, and he said, "Ah, Nice, pas de glace, pas de neige, et trop froid, pas bon." The expression, pas bon, is French slang meaning, no good. Nowadays, a lot of them have adopted the English phrase, and the kids in the region where Americans have lived use it, and in fact have acquired a lot of American words and slang. A young Dartmouth man, who left college last spring for Plattsburgh, was made a lieutenant in the infantry and was hit by shrapnel a couple of days ago. He died in the first aid station near Sherman's dugout. I'm not allowed to say who it was, because I don't think the official report has gone out yet. In general, things are not very active here, except in the air, and occasionally at night. However, both sides are sending shells off and on. A few are landing around here. I can hear them. Well, so long. Your brother, Chan. P.S. I forgot one important thing. While in Hanover, please get some of that good old maple sugar and have the folks send it around. Aussitôt que possible. Chan. March 6, 1918. Not to get into newspapers, please. Dear Father, last night, Sherman sent over, by another liaison agent, several letters which he had recently received, including one from you, written on Grandfather's birthday. These were handed to me this morning when I got up to go out on duty, along with a new letter from Emily, which came up last night. Now I have just eaten dinner, which meal is still going on, as several of the men are slow in waking up to get it. Yesterday I wrote to Alfred and Emily. You can't say I am neglecting to let you hear from me, but of course I will not always have so much of an opportunity. In regard to the Salvation Army, which you mentioned, I am sure that we have seen nothing of this organization since we hit France or the war area. I do recall a hut near the big camp at Southampton, which I never entered since it was smaller and less conveniently located than the YMCA. No doubt the SA is doing considerable of this work in England, but it does not compare with the YM, which follows the U.S. soldiers everywhere and is rapidly covering the French army as well, not to mention the big work of the British, Canadian, and other divisions. Speaking of YMCA, Mr. Garrett of West Hartford came up to our dugout last night and spent the night here, bringing a fairly large supply of things that we have been wanting, i.e. chocolate, hard candy, tobacco, candles, matches, etc. Since we have been without some of these things for some days, he was soon sold out. One of my squad had the kindness to buy something on my behalf as I was not in. Mr. Garrett also brought up a lot of oranges, two apiece for all of us, which were the gift of a Mr. Wiley. I hadn't tasted an orange since we were on the Atlantic Ocean in the steamer. Are the various outbursts in Congress against the War Department over by now? Of course, nothing of these is mentioned in the European papers, but such copies of The Current, as we see, have a good deal on the subject. Such stuff would make the soldiers over here somewhat annoyed, since we seem to be so well provided for, and are disposed to have a good deal of confidence in the government and the army chiefs. I hope the outcome will be for the good. I wonder what Dr. Meal had to say. It sure is interesting to hear of the great desire which people in Hartford evinced in his discourses. Dave Hitchcock just told me that his parents had received an invitation to hear Dr. Meal in Hartford. Dave also called my attention to the fact that my bunk is the best situated in the whole dugout, outside of the officers. I think it is true. It is a little niche off the corridor, with plenty of handy nails to hang boots, helmets, gas masks, toilet kits, Red Cross bags, overcoats, etc. I just stepped outside for a moment and found the sky dotted with black and white puffs of smoke, each of which shows where an anti-aircraft shell has just exploded. It was the French firing at a Boche plane which has started over our lines, probably to make a raid on their favorite prey, an observation balloon. Evidently, the shells were bursting close enough to cause Fritz to turn back, as he could be seen very high up in the sky, making for his own territory at a good clip. A battery of 75s is now sending shells from here to the German side. Said battery is very close to our dugout, but is well concealed, that I haven't caught a glimpse of it. Last night was fairly comfortable out of doors. For a long while, I was standing with a couple of boys overlooking quite a stretch of the front. They would explain the various things that we saw and heard. For instance, they could interpret some of the signal rockets. They could tell whether the various fusées accélérantes, or star shells, were Bosch, French, or American. They could tell me how to distinguish the sounds of the various machine guns, including the German Maxims, whose bullets were hitting with a spat in the trees near us from time to time. The Frenchman also called my attention to the various kinds of artillery that would fire now and then. It was tranquille for the most part, and at times we could even hear the rumble of the wagons, which were bringing up supplies and ammunition to some adjacent sector. I have acquired something of a war vocabulary in French, but can't spell most of the words. Also, I can read their newspapers easily, especially the war news, for the poilus are always willing to explain anything we ask them. Today, the weather is as much like April as the previous days have been like January. It sure is a great improvement. I am glad that you got our birthday telegram. Your son, Chandler. March 8, 1918. Dear Mother, we are still on the job at the front, and as I write, I can hear the booming of the nearby 75s. It is now in the middle of the afternoon. We don't know where we shall go from here, and the surprising thing is that this doesn't seem to be on anyone's mind. At least, it isn't being discussed very much. I suppose I shall, in a way, hate to leave this place. I don't know why, but so far I have felt that way whenever we moved. Did I tell you people of our departure from where we were billeted for so long in one of the best little villages in the province of, you probably know the names? We continued drilling right up to the last day. We also had to get all our guns and equipment in shape and to make a thorough inspection of not only our billets but of the whole town, including the streets, alleys, and backyards, so that when we left, I think the town was cleaner than it had ever been before. The day we left, we had to dispose of our cots, stoves, and barrack bags, then to roll our packs, which were then some heavy, and then to stand to, ready to embark. Everything worked on schedule and to the whistle of the top sergeant, and the procession started out, our company following the other Hartford one. That day we said goodbye to our friends in the village who wished us bonne chance and hoped that we would come back and visit them if we returned to that vicinity. There were some fine people there, as well as some particular characters of all kinds. In fact, there were more various distinctly individual types than you would have ever seen in an American town. They saw the serious side of our departure, au tranché, a lot more than we did. Young Henri, the café garçon, who lived downstairs in our billet, repeated more than once the expression, tranché, pas bon, and I heard one or two women, old ones, young ones, say that it was a pity that we were not home with our folks instead of going to the line. I suppose we can't blame them, but of course we were inclined to smile at what they said. When we lined up to partir, the populace was all out by the front doors, and anyone could see that they were sorry to see us go. I saw a couple of women who were really in tears. All of the school children were lined up in front of the schoolhouse to say au revoir. It was quite a scene, in spite of the fact that we were pretty busy at the time. I can't describe the trip we had, but of course, as we entered the war area, with its absence of civilian life and towns not shattered by bombardment, we had more and more to interest us. Our destination was a town where we lived in a big cave, dug deep in the soft rock of the district. We had some great times there. At present, I'm not getting much mail, but perhaps there will be some waiting when we get out from here. I hope you can keep sending little things to eat, such as peanut butter, molasses candies, such as you sent me once, maple sugar, etc., together with a little Edgeworth pipe tobacco. Yesterday, it was so warm that I ventured to take a sponge bath on a small scale, heating the water over a candle. A funny thing happened the other night when we were out standing by our mitrailleuse. The captain happened to be going by just then, followed by his orderly, who carried a square board or table used with various instruments to get range and direction. At that moment, we heard the whistle of a Boche shell, which sounded pretty loud to our inexperienced ears. I gave a jump into the hole, just as the shell exploded some distance behind us. The orderly also gave a wild leap for cover, and in doing so, he let fall the board, which landed edgewise on the helmet of the Dong Blies, who was in the hole already. Dong says he thought sure that he had a piece of shrapnel in the bean. Sherman was over here yesterday and brought me a can of jam from a French canteen near his sector. Lots of love, Chandler. March 11, 1918. Dear folks, well, here I am, back from the front, the region of the Soissons-Quinzes, the Mille-Étroits, the Bayeux, Saps, Poste de Secours, etc. However, we are only back to where we were before we took our little tour of the line. Not far back, as you would know if you could hear all the guns around here, popping at some Boches overhead just now. I happened to be riding in Ed Garrett's cozy little dugout down among the officers' quarters. As we came along a few minutes ago, I noticed a few searchlights, as if in search of hostile avions, but I couldn't hear any motors, so they must have been some distance away. Evidently, the French have now located them. One of the lieutenants, the one whom Jack Wiley is orderly for, just came into the room with a tremendous box of chocolates which had come to him from the United States and which he offered us. Speaking of boxes, I don't think any of those from home to us have been lost. Your careful packing has borne them to their destination in good shape. Sherman and I found the Boche are over us now, all right. They can be heard, plainly, even down here in this snug little abri. As I was saying, we found two packages from home when we came last night. One contained medicine and soap, also a scarf, and the other had some homemade cake, jelly, and literary digests. The second was the best for this reason, that we view with alarm any further accumulation of things to be carried around with us, since our packs have to hold all our belongings until we see our barrack bags again. About one cake of ivory soap in 6 months would take care of my requirements. Also, the present of medication was very thoughtful, and it may come into good use. As a matter of fact, colds and ill health seem to be a thing of the past in this outfit. When we can sit for several hours at night in a driving wet snowstorm, without cover, and have no signs afterwards, we should worry about colds. Speaking of snowstorm, we are now having some fine spring weather, and it is a treat to be able to come outdoors in the daytime again, to walk around without expecting a German shell to land on you. This afternoon, we devoted to cleaning up, and we needed it. I did a good job. Two of us went across a nearby ravine to where I knew there was a spring, where some poyou washed. We took water out to a hillside in the bright sun, made a fire, heated the water, stripped, and took thorough baths, observed only by a balloon which was directly overhead. We carried and heated the water in large tin cans. Formerly they contained bacon, and they are the favorite substitute for water pails. Then I heated more water, and by the aid of a board, washed the underwear, socks, and handkerchiefs, which I had just discarded for new. Incidentally, I used more soap than I had previously used in a month or two. The company is all together again, and you should have heard the hilarious outpourings of narrow escapes, peculiar situations, and funny incidents which both groups had to tell each other. I have just seen the magazine L'Illustration of March 2nd. Don't fail to see it at the library, especially the leading full-page drawing. Very true to life, and if you don't believe what is written under it, ask me when I get back. I expect to write again soon. Your loving son, Chandler. March 16, 1918. Carried in gas mask case and added to letter of March 25. Postmark, March 28. Dear Mother, not many days ago, I wrote of being at the front and having the opportunity of firing at the enemy and of seeing how it was to be under fire, especially artillery fire, since that is what causes the famous knee-knocking sensation to new troops. Just now, I find myself again in the trenches, but in an entirely different situation from before. We have very interesting little places here, which I would not be allowed to describe. Although this is not, at the present instant, what is called a very attractive sector, yet things are going on all of the time, and whatever is going on, we don't have to wait to learn about it in the newspapers, nor even to get it second hand from some runner carrying meals to the infantry through a communications trench. It is an interesting place, and especially as our little combat unit and dugout, I am de boss, since my superiors, lieutenant and sergeant, live some distance away and may only visit us once or twice a day. Odd snatches of sleep during the daytime are all that we get now, and shoes and gas masks are never removed, yet I don't feel half as sleepy as I did at the other place, where we had all these periods of several hours off duty at a time. Where we were before, the thing that worried us most was the bad weather. Now, our little dugout is well heated, and the weather is fine. Furthermore, we are a lot more independent, cooking some of our meals, and eating as much as we want, whenever we want, provided the grub keeps coming. The high quality of our eats is the envy of the infantrymen who are with us. For instance, yesterday morning we had bacon and eggs, which we fried. Today we had griddled cakes. Our supply of jam, coffee, cheeses, etc. is more ample than it was behind the lines. By the way, our friends here of the infantry are a very good bunch of fellows. You've got to give the infantry credit for taking the most active and dangerous part in the war, especially those on the listening outposts. Those fellows drop in on us a good deal, and they sure have some interesting things to say. Did you know it? Mr. Simmons, who used to be in the assessor's office in Hartford, now a second lieutenant. He knows Father, as well as everyone else in Hartford, apparently. He likes our dugout, says it is more comfortable and better ventilated than his own. Also, he likes to talk about Hartford, so he spends most of his time conversing with us here. Perhaps you will hear from him later for this reason. During a little bombardment by the Boches this morning, a gas shell happened to land and explode in the trench a few yards from our position. A couple of minutes later, along comes the lieutenant, and noticing the pieces of shell laying in the trench, the gas shells don't explode with very much force. He poked around until he found the four or five fragments that made up the pointed tip, which relics he handed to his orderly to keep. Now his idea is to have these made into something useful, like a paperweight, as soon as we can get out of the trenches, and send it to Mayor Haggerty of Hartford with a letter telling of how it fell among the youth of his city, etc. If Lieutenant Simmons carries out this plan, it may appear in the papers. Sherman is back with the rest of the company. In fact, only a very small number of men are with us. There is one other corporal whose position is not far from us. In my bunch, I have a Hobie Hyde and Harold Kropp. They are asleep here now, and so close that I could touch them by reaching up from my own bunk. Well, we are confident that we could make it interesting for the Boche before they get very far in this direction. At any rate, the French order for this post read in part, Il doit se défendre jusqu'à la mort. And the order hasn't changed. I probably will write again soon. Your loving son, Chandler. March 27, 1918. Dear folks, this evening I was just talking to Lieutenant Simmons of Hartford, who was up with us in the line as I wrote before. His infantry is in a town near us. Also, I had a little talk with a Dartmouth 1917 man, whose name I couldn't recall, who is a lieutenant in the same regiment. Last night, Lieutenant Bissell of West Hartford was in town. I saw him but did not speak to him. Now that we are in a permanent place, at least for a day or so, perhaps a few weeks, we are getting some of our back mail which couldn't come to us while we were traveling. A lot of fellows have received various Hartford newspapers, and it sure is interesting to get all the news, especially the war news, describing our own doings at the front. Of course, none of this stuff is in the Paris papers, so I request that you send all of the Hartford papers, especially the war news that you can, because it is better to read this stuff a few weeks late than not at all. This applies to war news, especially that dealing with American troops. I had no idea until now that so many details were appearing in the American press. You probably know what sector we were in, and a good deal of what happened. At least this seems to be disclosed in various dispatches that I have seen. In the accounts of Al Edie's death, the place was given wrong in the Hartford Current. Edie was a young Dartmouth lieutenant who was hit by shrapnel and died in a dressing station right next to Sherm's dugout. It was a nearby sector, and the other side of a ruined town. If you want to look up accounts of activities where we took some part in, they should be about the dates of February 28, March 5, and March 16 and 17, especially the latter, when I was up with the infantry in the front line. Don't forget to look up L'Illustration of March 2, which has a drawing of an incident which we were near, although we had no part in it ourselves. Well, the Yankee division has come through its first chance at the front line in good shape, and it is rated pretty well. Our own Hartford battalion had the distinction of having no casualties, which caused some French to call it the bomb-proof battalion. I trust our gun found Germans for some of several rounds that we shot. Only one gun of the company fired more than we did. Speaking of our division, or rather the American Army in general, one afternoon I happened to be standing at our battalion headquarters and noticed several French officers who were watching with interest what was going on. Autos and trucks moving about with supplies, errands, etc., in a busy manner. And our interpreter, or in Army slang, interpreteur, who happened to be there, remarked, "Do you know what those officers are saying? They are just saying, these men know how to make war." This was at least a compliment for our headquarters, back on the line. I can also say that our American artillery is fine, and we're always on the job answering all of the Boche batteries and putting across a heavy and accurate barrage whenever it was necessary. As for my own part in the line, the first time I was up, it was about half of the company. I rode home several times while there. We lived in a dugout which was not under much of any enemy fire at the time, and we had to walk some little distance to our firing positions when our guns were. We walked on a path above the ground at night, unless the Boche were firing in that direction, otherwise through a bayou or a communication trench, which made a longer trip than the trench needed to be. When we got relief from our tour of duty, we returned to our positions back of the lines, where we lived in a cave, which I have mentioned before. I wrote letters from there about March 12, which I wrote in Ed Garrett's dugout. Did you get it? Just before that, I had received orders that three of us, our section sergeant, Sid Rota, Corporal Fop Allen, and myself, were to return the next day to the front with two machine guns and a small number of men to work them. In this way, three of us with our lieutenant saw twice as much service as the rest of the company. The place where we went this trip was down in the front line with our guns set so as to mow down the Boche if they should come across no man's land. Only the listening posts were ahead of us at various places. We were tight with this infantry and could see and hear everything that was going on, so we had more excitement in one night than in a week at our former location, and the suspense was several times as noticeable. I wouldn't have missed it for a lot. Pop Allen's gun hadn't been in position for an hour when the German shells began to land around us, and one of their 77s went through the camouflage and wall of his emplacement, and right then, under the seat of his gun, breaking a piece right out of the tripod and burying itself in the sandbags behind the guns. Luckily, it didn't go off, or a couple of our men would not be with us now. No shell happened to land quite as near my gun, but they were not many feet away. One night, and the Boche machine gun bullets had a habit of whistling around at almost any hour. We were finally relieved just in time for our party to get back to the cave home for a few hours' sleep before our whole battalion left there for the trip right away from the war area. No chance to get a bath. We shaved at railroad station while waiting to entrain. Since then, we have had some great times and have seen a lot of fine places, but I shall have to postpone that spiel until another letter. I have just spotted here in the YMCA one of the infantrymen who lived in the little dugout with us at the place which I described above. Yours, Chandler.